Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need. Today's episode is a history lesson, a look into a time period our next guest calls Canada's Era of Rebellion. It's a part of our past the powerful would rather be forgotten. It doesn't fit with their necessary narratives, and you know, it just might give people some ideas. We're not generally taught the stories you're about to hear in school. And as we go through the years before and after Confederation, clear patterns emerge that really imitate a lot of what we're seeing today here in Canada and over in Palestine. There are stories of brutal suppression of resistance, land theft, execution of Indigenous leaders, the retelling of history, all for a very specific end. It's always much easier to understand Canada's behaviors when we hear its true history. That being said, let's meet our history teacher for the next 45 minutes.
Hello, audience. I'm Bothered Boy. You can find me on YouTube and Twitter and TikTok. And yeah, if it's not obvious by the name, I'm bothered by a lot of things. When not ranting about stuff on the internet, I am also reading up on history, reading as many books as I can, which as an adult millennial working a very busy job and then doing other volunteer and these other side projects means I actually have much less time to do that than I would like. But it means you get to learn a lot about history, both domestically and internationally. And so that's what I'd like to talk to you two about today.
Because, yeah, I took a look at some of your work on YouTube. And the one thing that really caught my eye was an extensive video on Canada's dark history. So, of course, my ears perked up there because we're no stranger to Canada's colonial history here on the show, but we haven't spent much time actually diving into it. And then when I asked you, do you want to come on and specifically talk about that? I guess that was pretty broad. We've got a pretty dark history. It is a long, dark history, so we can't fit that into an hour. And Bothered Boy, you honed in on what you're calling Canada's Era of Rebellion. Why was that important to discuss now?
So there's this myth, and perhaps you and other listeners can kind of expand on this and corroborate it with your own experiences. But when we're taught history in our schools, we tend to see it in the lens of how it compares as a mirror reflection of America. So, you know, they had their violent revolution. We got it peacefully, right? You know, we asked nicely because we're so nice, right? Like, that's the kind of idea. Is that I see you two nodding your heads. I don't know if viewers can see that, but
absolutely. Yeah. And it explains so much, right? It explains why they're so violent and we're so peaceful, why our police are so kind and theirs are so awful. Like it fits into a lot of really good Canadian narratives.
It's what I call better than Americanism.
Oh, yeah, you do have a name for it. Yeah.
Yeah, which I mean, like the bar is in hell, so that's not a difficult bar to clear, you know, like, oh, hey, we're better than America. It's like, wow, so we're 36th instead of 37th. Oh, like, can we not at least try for a podium finish? You know what I mean? But to, again, go back to the point of like, you know, the idea of our, you know, we got our independence by asking nicely and the government motto of peace, order, and good government. But then it's like, hey, where did that come from? How did we get elected governments here? And the answer is we had to ask for it. And by ask for it, I mean rise up violently in rebellion. What I mean by the era of rebellion is more or less five events or periods of time that were happening in both pre-Confederation Canada and post-Confederation Canada. The first is the rebellions of 1837. I'm going to dive into all these in like a little bit, but I just kind of want to outline the broad strokes, events, and timeline that I'm going to try and hone in on here. So you have the rebellions of 1837. They're joined together, and they were the rebellions of Upper Canada and Lower Canada. The Lower Canada one was more successful because that was more organized and more they had more population as well in Quebec. The other sort of period of time is an era that goes incredibly underreported on in our history, and it's poorly understood. But it is an era of what's basically Protestant terrorism and like riots and like led by the Orange Order in the period between 1839 and 1866. And one of these such events, which is usually kind of isolated more as a more unique standalone one, is the burning of Parliament in Montreal in 1849 in protest of the Rebellion Losses Bill. And again, I'm going to come back to all of this. Post-Confederation instances we have, and I'll have people note that this is also where it takes a more indigenous turn. You have the Red River Rebellion of 1869 and 1870, and then you also have the Northwest Rebellion of 1885. Both of those were ultimately led by Louis Riel, although the first one was also alongside the Métis Provisional Government of Manitoba at that time, whereas the Northwest Rebellion was a whole different thing. We are going to get into that.
Oh, like, please tell me we're going to spend time on the Red River Resistance.
Yes, but these are kind of like the core broad strokes. Now, I don't know if either of you have heard of any of these, like, in history. I know, Jesse, you were like, yes, Red River, so at least that one, but anyone else familiar with the others?
Definitely took this through university, but the audience, who knows?
Yeah, well, I hope we hear from the audience about this. So those are kind of like the broad strokes, and I want to point out that that does occur between 1837 and 1885. And so you're looking at like damn near half a century, like, you know, 48 years of various different events and struggles. And while all of them are by like different groups of people, so the Upper and Lower Canada Rebellion were by, you know, reformers and the Patriotes in Quebec. The Orange Order was, of course, like very Protestant, very Anglican, very much anti-Catholic. And so they were, you know, anti-Irish immigration and then just kind of anti-immigration in general. These are different groups. And then, of course, with the Red River Northwest Rebellion, Indigenous resistance. So these are all different groups, but kind of like, I guess you could argue some of the foundational groups of the idea that like the sort of baseline initial demography of Canada. You had French, English, and Indigenous peoples, and these are all reflections of what they wanted to see and where they had hoped that the country would go. And all of them have the same kind of core, which is that they felt that the current government of the time was not adequately supporting them and their needs or having their vision reflected by the people who were allegedly governing them. So we'll start with the Rebellion of 1837. That ultimately, to make things very simple without going into too much nitty-gritty politics of like a further few decades beforehand, was basically about a lack of political reform. In the wake of the War of 1812, two emerging kind of aristocratic groups emerged in Upper Canada and Lower Canada, what we now call Ontario and Quebec. And on what would become Ontario, you had the Family Compact. In Quebec, you had the Chateau Clique. The Chateau Clique was, even though it had a French name, it was mostly Anglophone, ruled by the Anglophone elites that had been brought in by the British in the wake of its conquest. But there were also members of the French seigneurial, like, feudal class that also saw that their interests were best served by joining this group. And so there were French people in there and had some influence, which is why it was seen as separate from the Family Compact. But ultimately, at the end of the day, these were two largely Anglophone, pro-British, pro-monarchy groups. They were pro-liberal capitalism and, crucially, anti-democracy. And so they refused any kind of real accountability for governing of these colonies up and through to the lead up of the rebellions of 1837. Now, there are some scholars who suggest that these rebellions should be seen as part of the wider, what are known as the Atlantic Revolutions. That's the American Revolutionary War, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, the Batavian Revolution, the Irish Rebellion of 1798, the Spanish-American Wars of Independence. So like all this was kind of happening around the same period of time. And I don't disagree with that, but I also want it to be seen as kind of like the start of Canada's own ongoing era of rebellion that would ultimately help shape and form the Canada we have today, for better or worse.
When we've talked to folks who, we spoke to someone who had fought in the IRA or had been in the IRA and trying to explain how you get to a point of rebellion, and it's usually a mixture, obviously. You get there because of the oppressive conditions in which everyone is subjected to, right? That's how you get critical mass, because everyone is experiencing a wrong, an injustice. You live and breathe it, and the enemy is clear, right? It's in terms of all of these that existed. But you don't you aren't successful and you don't gain the courage to perhaps go there without historical references, without being shown previous victories. So it's usually a combination of both historical influence, right? Because Danny Morrison was talking about just reading about all of the revolutions that had come right before them, the tactics, how they got there, what they did wrong. And it really did form how they visualized what could be possible and how to do it.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly what was going on with the rebellions of 1837. These people saw that, at least now at this point, there were several other nations, whether it was America, France, the Dutch, a.k.a. Batavia, as it was briefly during this sort of period of time, and then like the subsequent Kingdom of the Netherlands. So they saw that, like, hey, you can have a government and also still a kingdom, at least in theory. Of course, in this case, the Patriots were having a more North American view of wanting an actual independent republic. But at the end of the day, what they wanted was political reform. And it was actually Louis-Joseph Papineau, one of the main Patriots in Quebec and a major leader of the rebellion and like a political and thought leader of the St. Lawrence Valley at the time. He very much initially wanted reform and wanted things to be peaceful. He like outlined a whole list of things that the governments, like the governors of the different colonies could do to like, hey, we'll shut up if you just do even like half of these to get started. And they all said no, because again, they were anti-democratic. They were incredibly corrupt and they didn't want to share power. It was basically like a group of rich people appointing each other as like their own little like executive council with no accountability to anyone but like the crown and like one court back in London. And it was kind of just like their own personal fiefdoms.
Well, many of them were rewarded this land, right? Like they were rewarded this land for conquering
away from like the indigenous people.
This is the mentality of the colonialists. Why would they cede power to the populace? That's not why they came to the New World, right? They wanted to be lords of a New World.
Yeah, yeah. You know, eventually, you know, when they say no, we're not doing any of that. It's like, okay, so you have chosen violence, and the Upper Canada Rebellion was kind of hilarious in how it was like, okay, we got one battle at a mill because someone was a rat and it just fizzled out after that. Except like, yeah, we're totally independent on this island in like the Niagara River region. And then some Americans were like, okay, yeah, we'll like send some dudes to help you guys. And then eventually it was crushed from like the American side because they were getting annoyed with it too. And it's like some rebellion, guys. But meanwhile, the Lower Canada Rebellion, they actually had several initial victories against British and Canadian militia, which forced the British to take it more seriously. Like there were several actual engagements, and then eventually it was defeated. And many of them, including Louis-Joseph Papineau, fled into exile. Many of them just fleeing across the border into America. And so that was kind of like the first deal of like, okay, we've just had like several rebellions in Canada. What's going on? So they send Lord Durham to commission the Durham Report to be like, okay, so what is it with our English colonies and getting uppity? And he basically came back and said, so it's because they want democracy, so we should give these people democracy, at least some limited form of democracy.
Wait, you're not using scare quotes, because there's no way Lord Durham went back and said these people like deserve democracy. It was like, listen, if you don't want to lose the whole fucking plot, you're going to have to pretend to give them representation. Because we know, like, in the end, like, that was my first note when you started, is like, how did we get elected government? Okay, we got elected government, but don't let him say that we ended up with fucking democracy.
Oh, well, we're still just getting started on this because, like, the plot thickens, let me tell you. The other thing that he suggested was that Upper Canada and Lower Canada should be united into a single political polity in order to assimilate the French Canadians because they were so different. So, you know, there was that fun whole chestnut. And that's also part of why the United Province of Canada was unfucking workable, which is why they eventually crashed the Maritime Union Conference. And that eventually, that was the Charlottetown Conference. And so that became the first conference of Canadian Confederation because they were thinking, hey, you know, we kind of have all these different colonies in the Maritimes of New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Nova Scotia. We should maybe unite to kind of consolidate some things, make it easier to govern and interact with each other. And the United Province of Canada, which was geographically and like population-wise way more massive, kind of just crashed the conference and said, hey, can the Province of Canada join your little union idea? And it's like, wait, what? And that's kind of how things got started. It was kind of that weird air quotes, happy accident. And, you know, Sir John McDonald, such a visionary leader. I'm like, he crashed a conference, probably drunk, and threw out this idea, and people actually started considering it. The issues of the rebellions then bring us to the burning of Parliament in 1849 and the Rebellion Losses Bill. The Rebellion Losses Bill, to again oversimplify a whole lot of stuff, was basically trying to pay some amount of reparations to people whose land was damaged, but not necessarily by the rebels, by the army. The army actually did a lot more damage than the rebels ever did. Classic tale as old as time, right? But the other thing that the Rebellion Losses Act or bill or whatever would also do was allow clemency for most, not all rebel leaders, but most, including Louis-Joseph Papineau and like other notable leaders, to return and be granted amnesty. So they wouldn't face jail time, not necessarily saying that they would, you know, be popular or even not have to deal with violence or threats of violence. But at least like, if you come back, we promise not to imprison and or kill you, was basically it. Papineau was still very popular in Lower Canada. He had really no issues. And that's part of what pissed off the people who eventually burned down Parliament in 1849. It was actually the Tories and, again, members of the Orange Order in Montreal. So Montreal was still at this point very diverse, but it had a significant Anglophone component by this point in time, because at this point we're talking like 50 years or so after New France became part of the British Empire. And so that's a long time for Anglophones to come in, start setting up shop, you know, exploiting the local populace, be it Indigenous or Canadien, and giving themselves preference over the existing French-Canadian Catholics. And so they were really mad about this idea of letting, you know, traitors back. And they also didn't like the idea of providing compensation for the actions of the army. They saw that as a sign of disloyalty to the crown, because, again, this is the Orange Order. They are very Protestant, very pro-monarchy. They are just awful. So what they did to protest this was they set the then Parliament of Canada in Montreal ablaze while they were sitting in session. And of course, the fire like spread to other corners, and the protesters had allowed firefighters to like address the blazes around. But if firefighters tried to get to Parliament, they said, no, absolutely not. There's a different building over there that needs your help, not this one. And like, as much as I hate the Orange Order with like every fiber of my being, I have to, you know, hashtag gotta give it to them on that one point of like, no, you know what? This building doesn't need your help. The others do. Like that I do respect. But yeah, that then brings us to the wider context of Orange Order violence, which again kind of really picked up in the wake of the rebellions, because they were like, man, these Quebecers, these French Canadians, the Canadiens, the Habitants, they are just way too uppity and way too Catholic, and they don't love the monarchy enough. So we're going to make it everybody's problem now. During this period of like pre-Confederation history, was some of the worst political violence ever seen in Canadian history. And to also tie it back to the rebellions and the idea of responsible government, we have the Fathers of Confederation, but very few people know about or appreciate the Fathers of Responsible Government in Canada, which is Robert Baldwin and Louis-Hippolyte Lafontaine. These two guys had to endure so much shit fuckery and threats of political violence, and like, you know, I think even Hippolyte Lafontaine had like people shooting rounds into his house and would like accost him in the street, and he had to like physically fight them off, because these two were trying to get responsible government for like all peoples, including, of course, the French Canadians.
Not all peoples.
Well, OK, all the citizens and like the white people at this time.
Because at that same year in 1849 is when women were explicitly denied the vote.
Yes.
Right. And the same year they burnt the Parliament.
Yes. No, that's just the nice, good white landowning men. Of course. Yes. That's the caveat here in terms of this time. But the idea of the French having any kind of responsible government and therefore some accountability to the people governing them really rubbed a lot of awful people the wrong way. And so in this period of time, the Orange Order was responsible or involved for no less than 29 riots in the city of Toronto alone, 16 of which had like direct political inspiration. And that's just in Toronto. Toronto at one point, even like at the turn of the century, in like the 1890s.
Wait, who throws a riot without political inspiration? What were the other ones for then? Just shits and giggles? Like,
the direct political inspiration was more for like deliberately trying to stop polls and elections from happening, or some political leader was saying, no, we shouldn't let these people or like this bill through. And it was kind of like stochastic terrorism is basically the diplomatic way of saying like direct political inspiration here. And then the other instances were more like local Orange Order. They had, instead of clubs, they had lodges. And these were usually pogroms against Irish Catholics, because a lot of these people, they came from Britain, but others were also Protestant Irish.
And these are Masons, right? These would be who make up your Masons and your loyalists.
In some cases, yes, but no. Like, there were other kind of lodges, not just Freemason lodges. And so the Orange Order lodges were separate and distinct because they had their own unique vision.
They were about, you're talking about the same demographic.
Yes.
Right? These are going to be the same men belonging to both lodges.
White Anglo-Saxon Protestants, yes. It's basically
the same purpose.
The classic, yeah. And so, like, when it wasn't direct political stuff, it was more about, like, oh, we need to get rid of these Catholics, whether they're Irish Catholic, French Catholic, the handful of, you know, Portuguese or Basque Catholics that were in Montreal or in other areas at the time. Like, it was just about Catholicism bad, French people bad, Irish Catholics very bad. You know, like the Orange Order was directly responsible for preventing Louis-Hippolyte Lafontaine from being elected at first in like the 1841 election, I think it was. Because they had so entrenched themselves as a position of power in pre-Confederation Canada, there was basically a combination of gerrymandering and actual poll violence. Like, you even had newspapers sometimes saying, we need to go out and hold the poll to prevent people from declaring their vote. Because back in that day, in order to vote, you actually had to like physically go and declare your intention to vote for someone, and that would be marked in a registry. And so a lot of poll intimidation was used because there wasn't like secret ballot casting or anything like that. So, like, you know, strong-armed people, sometimes even armed with weapons, would try and prevent people from going into different polls in a riding and voting for the actual candidate they would want to see. So, yay, democracy in Canada, even though we already had technically by this point in the different colonies gotten responsible government. And so that's kind of like, yay, we have democracy, but now we have a ton of political violence. And that never gets mentioned in our history books as like a thing we had to deal with for decades. The Orange Order then like set their sights in on Baldwin even more hard. Like, they had already had it in for him before, but now they were like, oh, absolutely. And so due to outright poll violence and like attacking Baldwin indirectly and also some of his allies, like political allies directly, the Orange Order forced Baldwin to have to like run, I think, in Rimouski, which Lafontaine helped him with. And so that was kind of like, you know, good to see of like, oh, hey, the English, some English Canadians aren't all bad and not all French Canadians are completely, you know, isolationists, etc. So it's like, oh, look, maybe we could work together. This glorious dream of French and English working together. But the Orange Order also especially hated Baldwin because he sought to outright outlaw them as an order and their violence in 1843, because he had had enough after like decades of seeing their violent ways and basically like domestic terrorism. He was like, yeah, no, this organization has to go in the name of peace and democracy. And of course, they didn't like that. And they managed to actually stonewall him a few times. But in a weird way, because of how weird the United Province of Canada was, they were able to actually find him a seat to run and win in what was then Canada East, which is now Quebec. So, you know, I find that that's never mentioned enough of like, hey guys, we should maybe talk a bit more about the Orange Order basically doing a lot of like election intimidation and like violence and domestic terrorism, including arguably the burning of Parliament. So it's like, yeah, can we talk more about Canada's weird period of Protestant terrorism? So there was that. And then that finally ended when like enough people kind of started having enough of their shit. And again, weirdly enough, led by like the pro-peace, like the Children of Peace Quakers, and having rallies in support of Baldwin and Lafontaine, that finally a lot of the like overt Orange Order violence started to subside. And then it became more about like secret backroom deals and like helping each other out. And that's why like until 1950, I think, was the first election in Toronto where someone who was not a member of the Orange Order was elected mayor of Toronto. But they were still around. I think they still are today in certain random parts of like the countryside. You can still occasionally come across an orange lodge. And I'm like, huh, okay, interesting. And again, crucially, many members of the family compact and some members of the Chateau clique had a very Tory-minded outlook. Same with the Orange Order. And so between the family compact, the Chateau clique, and the Orange Order starts to eventually coalesce into like the official kind of form of like Toryism in Canada, which became the like various iterations of the Conservative Party or Conservative Parties, which is also why they are known by the nickname Tories. Fun fact, kids, Canada's conservative political class stems from these three awful anti-democratic, anti-immigration, anti-Catholic, anti-Indigenous groups.
I'm not sure that would surprise anybody.
Nothing has changed. Right? Yeah. Like, but just that it's like, you know, that's the lineage that no one ever really talks about. It's just like, you know, just, you know, good values that came together. I'm like, no, 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 no.
Well, fun fact, just the other day we were shitting on Pierre Poilievre. And
as one does.
Yeah. And when he was minister of some bullshit ministry aimed at democracy, one of his goals was actually to change who gets to decide the poll supervisors. So just as you're talking about Orangemen supervising polls in their own way, he thought the victor should get to appoint the next poll supervisor for the election. So that's just a throwback to
that's not his homies in the at all.
Orange Order there. It didn't, that was amended out, you know, the Senate even saw through that, but yeah. They haven't changed much.
Yeah. Side note, there's a weird reason why like Canada like initially deliberately chose to have an unelected Senate, but.
Oh, we tell our audience that all the time is to protect the rich. And they've said so explicitly.
Yeah. But yeah. So then finally at this point, you know, we're getting into Confederation finally happening. But now there's like some new challenges going on. And of course, like in the backdrop are the Fenian raids, but those are mostly Irish American. So I wanted to kind of hone in on sort of more domestically driven things. So this brings us to the Red River Rebellion.
Resistance,
I guess. Yeah. you're kind of spoiling it a little bit.
Sorry.
Because there's a reason why it's called Rebellion, or how the name Rebellion stuck, even though it's kind of not really apt when you learn what actually happened. But that's part of why I wanted to get into it. So spoilers, Jessa, spoilers.
I just like to yell the word resistance. Don't worry.
And what a resistance it was. I mean, well and truly. This area, which would become Manitoba, was, of course, inhabited for millennia by Indigenous peoples. And then with the arrival of predominantly French, but also some Irish and Scottish voyageurs, coureurs de bois, fur traders and trappers, that allowed for a very interesting intermixing, which is how you get the Métis, which is why they're seen as their own sort of one of the three distinct Indigenous peoples of Canada. You have the First Nations, the Métis, and the Inuit. These are all seen as distinct for various different reasons. They had settled here in this land, which eventually had become, like, air quotes, owned by the Hudson's Bay Company. And it was the entire Hudson's Bay watershed. And so that was all property of what was then a massive and incredibly rich and successful corporation, which is still around to this day. HBC still exists.
Sort of.
Like, it's weird to think about that. This is like,
We're killing them out slowly.
I know, but still, it's like this thing has been around for like 350 years and at one point, air quotes, owned like damn near 50% of Canada's land mass. Like, it's weird to think about.
Rupert's Land is what it was called.
So then, you know, these people had been living there and the HBC was kind of like, yeah, whatever, just give us the furs and it's fine. We don't really care. And then, you know, wary of American expansion and then also bringing in BC as a province, like, you know, oh, hey, we got to connect. Got to connect the West and the East. Got to make this happen. Got to complete the colonial project, the British colonial project. Got to connect it East to West.
The railway.
What ends up happening is the government of Canada says, okay, we should buy Rupert's Land from the Hudson Bay Company. And so the HBC, already making money, just makes even more money selling off land that wasn't theirs that they're already exploiting. And they kind of just left the people who had mixed and settled there in the lurch. Especially the Métis, who had settled in the Red River area. And so what ends up happening And so the government of Canada starts sending like surveyors there to kind of be like, oh yeah, hey, we're going to see if, you know, this land is right for settlement and or basically like internal colonization, for lack of a better term. And the Métis were like, hey, what about us? We've kind of already lived here. Some of us have farming communities. Many of us still hunt buffalo. And
I just want to say, like, it was actually really organic at this point, too. A surveyor was caught on what someone considered, you know, their land, and they called their neighbor over to be like, what the fuck? And you know who their neighbor was? Louis Riel. Discovering this, you know, that's how he started. His neighbor calls him over and says, look what they're doing here. And, you know, I like that part because everyone could be that, you know, you see something and you're just like, what? No, this isn't your land to sell. Like Hudson Bay, $1.5 million they're going to take from the government of Canada for land that isn't theirs. So here you have the conditions of oppression and injustice and a clear enemy, and continue.
Well, yeah. And what was also making the Métis nervous was that, you know, they had never, because it was, again, all private land by the Hudson Bay Company, allegedly, they didn't have like actual, you know, title to their land that they could show to the government of Canada to be like, yeah, see, this is certifiably mine. But they had what was at the time known as right of occupation. But with the land surveyors coming and just not really paying attention to them or respecting them as a local community at all, because Canada was just being like, oh, hey, we can send a ton of farmers from already currently crowded Ontario out west to the prairies. So we'll just like send Anglophones from Ontario through the north on like, you know, railroads and or, you know, up with canoes and whatnot. We'll just portage all the way out there down the Great Lakes and everything. We'll just, you know, steamboat, etc. Just get a whole bunch of Ontarians out to the, you know, the mouth of the prairies. And the Métis were like, hi, we're here, please and thank you. We have our own history, our own communities.
Everyone think of Gaza, though, at the moment, right? Like, backdrop of Palestine, right? This has really Israeli illegal settlement feels, right? You could see this pattern. It's been tried and tested.
Yeah, and so eventually the local Métis community starts organizing and saying, this is kind of in our best interest to, like, you know, try and solve this amicably, but also very much advocate for ourselves and our rights and our people. And so they did, but they kept being rebuffed by many of the surveyors and like other people showing up, including some very pro-Canadian people who were members of the Orange Order. They're coming back to haunt us again, folks. One such person who will become relevant very shortly is Thomas Scott. Thomas Scott was one of the people who very much did not like what the Métis were doing. And at one point, because it wasn't just Métis here, right? There had been some new arrivals and they were kind of nervous about, like, you know, oh, they're Catholic and also part of Indigenous and they're fine with the people who are fully Indigenous. I'm just kind of weirded out by all this. I'll be perfectly honest. I'm clutching my pearls if I had any. And so Louis Riel and the Métis Provisional Government said, okay, you know what? Yeah, we should also represent some Anglos in here. And so they had an equal representation of Anglos. The Métis Provisional Government was actually very accountable and representative and understanding of, like, it takes a village of diversity and this is all our homes and we want it to stay that way. That's really what it was. But then members of the Orange Order and, like, you know, newfound Canadian patriots like Thomas Scott actively fought against this. They continuously caused trouble, attempted to cause riots, and this is in part what kind of spurred the Métis Provisional Government and Louis Riel to direct people to occupy, and without a shot fired, by the way, but they occupied Fort Garry, which was kind of the basis of the Red River colony at that point in time. Whoever kind of controlled that kind of had control over the valley. The Orange Order and pro-Canadians did not like this very much. And eventually they busted out some of these dudes because they, of course, had been thrown in jail at one point. It's like, OK, you're making too much ruckus. We're trying to actually have a civil discourse with the government of Canada, because this entire time, Louis Riel and the Métis Provisional Government are in like correspondence with the Canadian government trying to seek the admission of Manitoba as a province under like Métis leadership and with certain protections for language and religion. And while this is happening, Thomas Scott is clearly shown to be like kind of a ringleader. And Eventually, Riel has enough of his shit and orders the execution of Thomas Scott. So, again, I just really want to stress here, it's the Orange Order causing our fucking problems for half of this.
It's like, fuck around and find out. That's what happened.
Yeah, yeah. But, of course, that caused a massive outcry in Ontario, which, again, at this point was very much under Orange Order control, especially in Toronto, which was the seat of political power and growing economic power at this point in time. And they were calling for, like, you know, war. They advocate for the sending of the Wolseley expedition to go out there. Riel is like, you know what? Yeah, maybe I should go into exile. And he does. And the Red River Rebellion ends when the Wolseley expedition arrives by both, like, portage canoe, but also the then burgeoning Trans-Canada rail line or whatever its official name was. And so when they finally arrive and they're like, yeah, we're taking back Fort Garry, it's like, okay. And that's kind of where it ended. But as Jessa kind of gave the game away earlier, not a shot was fired. So why do we call this a rebellion? Where was the actual rebellious nature? And that comes from, unfortunately, the people in Ontario who were so incensed at the death of Orangeman Thomas Scott that they saw it as, like, this is cause for war, for invasion. Look at this rebellion out west. Don't these people know any better? We're the true arbiters of civilized society. And so the term rebellion took hold in Ontario, which, as a growing seat of political power in nascent Canada, it kind of just stuck and was applied to the rest. But it really wasn't a rebellion. It was very much a resistance and an advocacy for rights of minorities and certain demographies. Like,
yeah, and it's important to contrast that no shots fired with the military response that the government actually did use. They didn't simply show up. 1,000 troops ended up terrorizing Métis people, killing many, and using rape as a weapon. And that is was the response the year after the siege of the Fort Garry. So it was a campaign of terror leashed upon the people as a response. So, yes, I imagine you're going to go into the formation of Manitoba now that ends up being anything but what they asked for.
Yeah, and that's kind of the problem, right? And that's what makes it all so tragic. And that will also lead, like, what happens in, like, the Red River, air quotes, rebellion, and what happened in the immediate aftermath of that event would also directly lead to the Northwest Rebellion of 1885. But yeah, first we should kind of finish up more with the Red River Rebellion and Manitoba, because I'm hoping people kind of got the idea of, like, oh, wow, it actually sounds like the Métis had a really good thing going on, you know, like representation of English and French and Indigenous and Métis and non-Indigenous. Like, this is all our home. We got space. We can share. We can govern. And we also want some protections for minorities that we know, such as we want education in French for our Métis children. And we also want the Catholic Church, because we've seen what's happened in, like, you know, eras of Orange Order influence and control. We don't want that here. So we also want some protections for the, like, emerging Catholic Church on the prairies. They managed to win some of those as concessions, but they were very piecemeal. And as we saw later in history with the Manitoba schools question, pretty much thrown out the door. And so what used to be a very multilingual community and, like, a very francophone center, like Winnipeg used to be a center of French speakers in the prairies. And now kind of the joke is that you can count on one, maybe two hands, the number of French speakers still left in Winnipeg. That's because of, again, kind of like what basically happened that people don't really think about or conceptualize is that Canada, you know, air quotes, colonized itself when it, like, took over Rupert's Land and the prairies to try and connect up with BC. That's why the Northwest Mounted Police were set up. And people forget that their first issue helmets were the, like, colonial pith helmets that are associated with colonialism in Africa and India, because that's what it was. They were sent out to kind of pacify the prairies and kill the buffalo to make the Indigenous people sedentary and dependent on government assistance and support. And that's why the government started withholding food from Indigenous people, forcing them to go into reserves in order to then get still substandard, awful food. No one really thinks about that enough, that, like, this whole area, in order to, like, you know, prevent America taking it, and in the name of, you know, for king and country and, air quotes, peace, order, and good government, Canada just colonized the prairies with people from Ontario and then also immigrants. Like that's part of why the prairies have such a Slavic influence to them, especially with Ukrainian and Polish groups in the prairies, is because they were taken for, like they were invited over by the Canadian government in what was known as the Last Best West campaign. You know,
free
hey, free yeah. farmland. Yeah. Free land that isn't yours. And just like, here you go.
And it's so funny that when we're taught history, that is sold still as a positive, that that was such an innovative idea. And as a, you know, especially someone who's not like house secure, if someone tells you that, oh, everyone was just given a plot of land, you could build a house. Like there was the inherent problems with that were never discussed to people, that that wasn't land to give out, that it created a lot of political tensions, that it was deliberately designed, like demographically, to, you know, whitewash areas of the country. But yeah, it's still just like such a, it was the state being generous, right? Just handing land out for those frontier pioneers, right? Pioneers are still very much the term that's used in history books rather than settlers or colonialists. It's a very heroic kind of term.
When one starts to realize the history, it's not, and it shouldn't be termed, you know, pioneers. I always like referring to Samuel de Champlain as like, you know, the world's first French tourist, but because it's like, oh, look at all the stuff he explored. I'm like, he had guides. He was being shown around. Like what? He didn't discover. He was taken on a big, expensive tour. Like with that, though, Fort Garry and then what eventually becomes Winnipeg and the province of Manitoba starts to become this hub for settler expansion ever further westward, and it becomes increasingly anglicized because, oh, well, we got to hold that in the interest of the greater Canadian state project of being, again, largely white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. This would ultimately result in so many of the initial promises and hopes for the provincial government of Manitoba to be completely undone within the span of a decade. And at this time, there weren't other provinces in the prairies, but there were districts. But like all these were still considered the Northwest Territories. These were just districts that they were parceling off to kind of try and administer better. The reason why the District of Saskatchewan is important is because it's the setting for the Northwest Rebellion of 1835. So recognizing that like what's going on in the prairies is a hashtag and like capital B bad thing, the Indigenous people start to fight back. This is where you have chiefs like Big Bear start to actively fight for renegotiating the terms of the treaties that they had signed because the treaties were not being honored by, again, the nascent Canadian government. So Big Bear is someone who people should be more aware of. And the idea of starting to actually coalesce and organize resistance up to and including armed resistance against this settlement because they were not honoring the treaties, they were not protecting the Métis, and by this point, again, because the idea of like, oh, well, we got to, you know, settle the land, i.e. farming, they were getting rid of traditional land management techniques. They were also, in order to facilitate this, mass killing off the herds of buffalo, which would also then facilitate them to say, oh, hey, Indigenous people, this is why you need to go to reserves and we'll give you food there. That was the plan. The forced, you know, like resettlement and like forcing into reserves of people, because people, not enough people realize that reserves aren't like little chunks of like Indigenous land that were left over. They're federal land. Indigenous nations don't hold title to reservation land in this country. So it's an imposition by the federal government to try and get them to be like, yeah, over here, away from the nice white people and the really good land and like potential economic opportunity. And so with all this backdrop going on and the recognition that like the promise had not been kept in Manitoba, the District of Saskatchewan, which saw at that point a fairly significant chunk of population, in part because that district has very good soil. It's a kind of black soil that is excellent for farming. And that's where the conflict blew up. The Métis and Indigenous nations rose up to fight back against this. And this is also where Louis Riel returns from exile. They initially got some very good key victories against the Canadian militia, but then that results in the Canadian government taking it a little more seriously and sending more troops. It was a four-day brutal siege of Louis Riel and Métis and Indigenous forces that finally ends in their defeat. And it also results in the largest mass hanging in Canadian history, which is something that never really gets mentioned enough, is that in the aftermath of the Northwest Rebellion, 8 people were hanged in like a single day, like no real excuse for justice or any kind of human decency. Just, oh yeah, no, we have to send a message. And it was the largest mass hanging in Canadian history. And even though there were many people in Eastern Canada, particularly in Quebec, who were pleading.
And those were of Indigenous, like Métis leaders.
Yeah, because they were the leaders of the rebellion. There was calls for clemency, especially in Quebec, having some sympathy with the plight of their fellow French Canadians and the sort of extended family, perhaps, of the Métis having that French connection. But the then Prime Minister, Sir John Macdonald, and also a classic form of dehumanization, said, Riel will hang even though every dog in Quebec barks in his favor. So that tells you a lot about Sir John Macdonald and how he viewed Indigenous people, Riel, and French Canadians. He saw them as animals, basically. Really unfortunate that, you know, the rights of Indigenous people were not respected. And in the case of the Northwest Rebellion, it was an actual rebellion. It came to violence. And even then, it was repressed brutally so, when the cause of the rebellion was, we want you to uphold your word. We're looking for representation and some protections. That was kind of like the last real sort of element of a rebellious nature that we would get until, again, in the Manitoba Prairie area, the Winnipeg General Strike in the 1900s. But that was more about workers' rights, and it was all mixed up with, like, the economy and the war. And so I tend not to include that within this. It feels like that one's definitely more of a working class and labor movement thing.
That's 40 years later, right?
Yeah, and it is much later, whereas, like, all these other events, for someone, you know, born in the 1830s, by the time they had become a full-grown adult and probably passed away, they would have seen and heard about a lot of conflict happening throughout what was now the new country of Canada. And the undercurrent of so many of these, if not all of these, is people wanted a hope and a vision for this land of theirs, whether it was yet called Canada or it would eventually become Canada. They wanted rights and protections for themselves, certain guarantees, be it of land, treaty obligations, respect, inclusion. And yet the state, and usually aided directly or indirectly by said Orange Order, which came up multiple times in many of these conflicts, it was just impossible to get that done. And so, like, we tend not to view this in the lens that I think is most appropriate, which is that this is a near 50-year period of time, both pre- and post-Confederation, which saw Canadians of all different stripes and religions and languages fight for things that we now take for granted and still are very much imperfect, in part because of these failures. All these things that we, you know, or like that liberals will think of, like, oh, you know, Canada's so great for these things. These were things that people had to fight and in many cases die for just to get attention of government and then get like a peddling little compensation or a throwaway, you know, little table scrap between asking for democracy and like a responsible government in the 1830s and the 1840s and having to fight against, again, Protestant terrorism in order to enact even just a modicum of that, trying to fight back against settler colonialism and disregarding treaties and all this had to happen, and in many cases with bloodshed. And yet we have the audacity to tell ourselves and or believe the lie that we are told in history class that Canada came about peacefully. I really hope that those listening realize that it was anything but peaceful. It's full of violence and confrontation and contradictions by the existing colonial state that just never gets talked about. And that's what's bothering me today.
I knew so little about any of that, right? And I mentioned before we hit the record button, you know, I took every history class that they offered at my high school.
Your Catholic high school.
My Catholic high school. And you got that all done in 56 minutes and 45 seconds. Yeah, even a bit. So, you know.
So there's no reason they can't be doing this.
No, definitely. But what I'm saying is like, yeah, no, we get very little in our history classes.
I skipped over a lot of nuance, though.
You think you skipped over a lot of nuance? I'm sorry. I'm gonna argue that they skipped over a lot more nuance.
I think 1864 is like the only marker in the history book in your era that you've talked about. But of course not. Like, we want to just sell ourselves as like the peaceful, even our foreign policy, we try to pretend like that is peaceful. We try to pretend that, yeah, it was a melting pot and that our form of democracy is a lot more organic than the Americans. And the Americans kind of own their image too, right? They're like, okay, we'll be the war hawks then. Yeah, we fought for it. We burned shit down. That's how we get shit done. And that's their approach. We all end up doing the same fucking thing because, like, we're not even any better than them. Folks got to go back to the episode with Tyler Shipley where we talk about Canada's colonial imagination.
That's such a good one.
It is, because he gives you a little more modern history where we've been told our foreign policy was X and in reality it was not. Like, there's all these moving parts under the surface and we're shaking hands and taking photos. In the meantime, you know, we're sending troops and formulating plots to overthrow governments. And you know, of course, we're not told that. Americans love to own it, though, but because, like, if you look at the formation of Canada, whatever that means, it's so shady. And so, of course, if people knew how shady those fuckers were back then, even if you look at the charter, you know, like the way that the charter sold to us is some sort of benevolent gift that, you know, gives us our rights. And it's all bullshit. It's all just placation, right? To maintain order, which means maintaining power. And like, bigotry plays into it. But in the end, it's land and power, all of it.
Yeah. And oh, no, Canada's so nice. Why don't these foreign nations ever vote alongside us at the UN? It's like, because A, we're an American puppet, and B, they don't like us constantly messing about in their nations.
I want to push back on one thing, the idea that we're an American puppet, because I think that's far too generous of a statement. I think that, you know, like, it's like, oh, you know, well, you know, we have to do what they say because important trading partner. I think we're a lot worse than that. I think we're a lot more malicious.
We're so dishonest about it.
Co-conspirators.
I'll go with co-conspirators because we're not just going along because we have to. We've drank the whole damn Kool-Aid and we're along for the ride.
I was just saying, we're the ones spiking the Kool-Aid because, like, it's that colonial model that's being repeated over and over again by the worst of the worst, the worst of the worst. Yet we still will have people like, I'm so proud to be Canadian and Canadian history. And my son is, like, still upset they make him stand for the national anthem and he doesn't even know half the shit. Like, you know, he's just like, but no, we are so proud of our history, weren't we?
Yeah, and that's a problem, which is part of why I try and fight back against it. Like, you know, for better or worse, this is my home. I was born and raised in Canada. I've lived in different parts of it and other parts of the world. And I want the people in my communities to be safe, happy, healthy, and thriving. Does that mean I'm married to the idea of Canada and will not absolutely tear a strip off of Canada, which it deserves to have done to it every single goddamn day, then yeah, I'm absolutely going to do that. But like, how come you can't be proud of this nation? It's like, buddy, look, hey, my grandfather fought in World War II. He was like, you know, in the tail gunner of Halifax bombers. He happily loved shooting down Nazis. There's a part of me that yearns for the same opportunity to shoot down Nazis, right? Like, there's that whole part of it. But at the same time, when I look at our history, it's like, okay, so you say you like our history. Why? What part? Like, please tell me why. And unfortunately, I can probably ruin it for you because, like, and again, the sort of caveat that people love, which I fucking hate, is when it's like, oh, Canada never had slavery. I'm like, you mean only officially 18, you know, because 1867. Yeah, see, no slavery. And I'm like, yeah, but then, you know, the act to limit slavery was in, like, I think 1831. The earliest settlements were in the 1630s, like the permanent ones that started sticking were in the 1630s, be they English or French. So we're looking at basically 200 years of slavery. By the way, did you know that the French Canadians had a book for how to engage in slavery properly, known as Le Code Noir, or the Black Code? Yeah.
Some people actually reveal how much history they know, they just disregard, because you'll hear the same people making that argument. It's not Canada's problem. That was with the Crown. That was with the Crown. So you do know. So you kind of do know exactly what has happened. You do have Canadian history in your brain, like the rudimentary stuff, but you just kind of pick and choose which you're going to apply.
But, like, we don't even have to look at history in terms of slavery. We can look right now, right? When it comes to our temporary foreign worker program, which has been described as a modern day form of slavery. I was out for dinner with my partner's parents last night. They're conservatives, and we were talking about migrant workers, and they were literally like, "That's slavery." Like, I didn't even use the words, and they were like, "That's slavery. How can we allow this to happen?"
Wow, good for those conservatives. That's a phrase I never thought I'd say.
You were practicing your rant with them, were you?
Oh, I've done seed planting there for sure. Let me just. But you know, like it brings up the phrase, you know, those who don't know history are condemned to repeat it, right?
No. We repeat it anyway. It's a model. We're just cut and paste.
I don't always love that phrase because I think it has like a bit of a history is a series of progress point of view to it, where it's like history is bad and the future is good and we must learn what happened to history so that the future can be good. But it's like, no, actually history also had good stuff that we can probably learn from. And so we some of the history I'd like to repeat maybe, but anyways.
That's exactly right. But, you know, they craft our history books with a very particular purpose, right?
I was talking to someone about this a while ago on like an episode of like Progressive Profiles that has yet to be uploaded because I'm so swamped with everything. But we had kind of touched on like, you know, Canadian history and like shared British colonial history. And one thing that came up, ooh, surprise kitty, yay. One thing that came up was like, you know, how Canadians teach history and sort of like, what's the message? Because there's a really good book out there. In fact, I think it's here on my bookshelf. Yes, hang on. Oh, so handsome, so cute. So this is a really good, pretty easily digestible book called The Uses and Abuses of History by Margaret Macmillan. Like, honestly, I was able to get through this in like a single uninterrupted evening. It's not too heavy and stuff. I think it's pretty easily accessible and digestible for a lot of people. And it kind of just hones in on the idea of how and why countries use history to their advantage or to try and sell a story or a narrative, and how it's also a reflection of what they like or how they see themselves, but also what they're most afraid of. And so then after reading that book and thinking, okay, so what is the context in which we Canadians teach ourselves history? And you realize very quickly that it's about pushing all our bad stuff under the rug for the purpose of like, you want good, proud people. So like, there's always that element of history to try and make proud, happy little patriots of your country in the interest of preserving power, right? But then the other aspect of that that I realized is that it's also trying to tell the story of like Canada's almost divinely ordained ascendancy into first world, modern world, middle power status. Like, you know, here's the story of how we succeeded. It kind of like Canadian history kind of reads like, you know, we started from the bottom, hard scrabble, almost borderline American dream, but it's the Canadian dream, don't you know? To like, you know, get it to like, yeah, and look at all this great stuff that we have now. It's because, you know, all the good stuff that you're learning about in your history books. We just need to do more of that and not engage with it meaningfully in any way. And it can happen to you too in this glorious land that you should be super proud of living in. And I'm like, oh, cool. So that's it. So I highly recommend this book. It's pretty good, pretty digestible, and will hopefully help people kind of think about history, not necessarily in a new lens, but just in a more understanding lens of like what it means and how it's used, especially by people in power and what that says about their goals, but also their insecurities. And then people can use that to make their own informed decisions and find ways of, you know, commenting on that, fighting back against it. So yeah, it's a good book. I recommend it.
Thank you, Bother Boy.
Thank you for having me.
That was, yeah, Canada's Era of Rebellion. We wish it had lasted longer and was more successful.
And we wish it had been more successful, yeah.
Yeah, another chapter in Canada's dark history.
One that I definitely expanded on more today than I did in that video. It is also a good video. People should go watch it and maybe throw me some Patreon dollars because it was expensive to make. I had to hire an editor. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But yeah, with that said, though, thank you both. I'm so glad I got to actually finally meet y'all and talk to y'all today. I love this podcast. So it feels, I'm feeling very giddy of like finally being able to be on here along with some other cool people that I know that have been on here. So I'm like, yay, I'm part of the Cool Kids Club.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Halu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.